For Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. For anybody who is an admirer of Emily Dickinson and her magnificent legacy of poetry, I recommend highly to you a beautiful book that I have enjoyed reading over the last few days titled Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, The Plants and Places That Inspired the Iconic Poet. This beautiful book by Marta McDowell not only gives us a great deal of information about Emily Dickinson, but also about where she lived and how she lived, and in particular, the plants that were important in her life. That is, the gardens, the forests, the orchards that played a role in Emily Dickinson's inspiration. And we find many, many references to this love in her poems and in her correspondence. And Marta McDowell has done a marvelous job of exploring all of this. She is someone who has written extensively on various gardening topics, and she has a particular connection with the legacy of Emily Dickinson in that she was the gardener in residence at the Emily Dickinson Museum in 2018. She has written several books before this, including The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder and All the President's Gardens. This beautiful book is titled Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, The Plants and Places That Inspired the Iconic Poet, published by Timber Press. Marta McDowell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg.
Before we dig into the substance of the book, I wonder if you could enlighten me and our listeners on what it means to be the gardener in residence at the Emily Dickinson Museum. What an intriguing title that is.
Well, I'm so glad that you like it, Greg, because it is sort of a title of my own creation.
Ah.
In that I was at a Emily Dickinson conference in 2017, and the executive director at the Dickinson Museum, Jane Wald, stood up and gave everyone an update on things that were happening at the museum. And she talked about their poet in residence and their artist in residence. And I'm sitting in the audience thinking, well, why not a gardener in residence? So I suggested it to Jane, and she, she was all for it. So we made that happen.
I like that.
Mm-hmm. So what did I do? I dug, right? I dug in the garden. So I went up. I live in New Jersey. So the museum, Emily Dickinson's home, is in Amherst, Massachusetts. And I went up for about, 6-8 times during the growing season for about, 4 or 5 days each. And really tried to keep the garden in good shape.
Mm. You open the preface to the book, the revised edition of your book, with these intriguing words. Emily Dickinson was an accident, for me at least, in terms of her gardens and my writing. Tell our listeners about this happy accident that made a whole lot of exciting things possible for you.
Yes, well, Emily Dickinson changed my life in a very real way. and not at the time when it might have made more sense, because I had been an American studies major in college. But after college, I took a different path, and I had a corporate job. I worked for Prudential for 20-plus years, and I was actually on a business trip. I was driving across Massachusetts visiting insurance agencies. So I worked in New Jersey, and I was up there, you know, sort of delivering the corporate message. And I had a spare afternoon, and I remember it distinctly because I'd gotten off the big highway, it's the Mass Pike, as they call it, and pulled into one of those regular rest areas that we have all over our interstates, and there's a brochure rack, and I see a brochure for the Emily Dickinson Homestead, it was called at the time, and I thought, oh, you know, that might be interesting. So I picked up the payphone, right, remember those, it was in the 90s, and I called and said, you know, can I still make it up there if I leave now from wherever I was? And she said, oh, yes, come up. And it's that point when I discovered that Emily Dickinson was a gardener, and I had always gardened. And it sort of opened a door for me onto her poetry and onto this idea that, well, maybe gardening has a connection to writing. And so it really went from there. You know, I started researching Emily Dickinson almost immediately after that. And then she was the topic of my first real article, and you know, my first book, and I've been working with the museum really since then.
One important point you make early in the book is when you write, Emily Dickinson as a gardener doesn't fit with the Dickinson mythology. Explain to our listeners, and maybe particularly for anybody listening who does not know all that much about Emily Dickinson, the ways in which this is true, the ways in which the common perceptions of Emily Dickinson do not jive with the notion of Emily Dickinson happily working in the garden.
Well, Emily Dickinson lived from 1830 to 1886. So, her, you know, her life spans the Civil War. It's all contained in the 19th century. And but her poems really weren't published until after her death, starting in 1890. So she lived this life. She publishes just a few poems, you know, maybe a handful during her lifetime. But really, she gets famous after her death. Emily Dickinson was an unusual person, without a doubt. But when the poems are published, to market it, you know, I think they really kind of hyped up this Emily Dickinson as recluse and Emily Dickinson in the white dress. And if anyone knows anything about Emily Dickinson, that's probably the image they have is, you know, person, white dress, standing in her bedroom, looking out, right, and very reclusive. And some of that is true. I don't mean to, you know, to sort of erase all that, but there's much more to the story. And that's what was a surprise to me. You know, I just thought of Emily Dickinson as someone who wore white and wrote a lot about death. But I was happy to learn more and then share more about her.
So explain how it is that we can know so much about Emily Dickinson's life as a gardener. I mean, the most obvious is that she makes frequent reference to various plants and flowers in the poetry that she wrote. But we can learn a whole lot more beyond just the poems themselves. Explain the kind of legacy that she left behind or the evidence that still exists that help us sort of fill in the blanks as extensively as we can.
So Emily Dickinson, in addition to being a really prolific poet, she wrote around 1,800 poems. She also was an absolutely avid correspondent. And if I had, you know, one wish, Greg, it would be that I could be, you know, just for a little while, a correspondent of Emily Dickinson, because her letters are incredibly rich and interesting, and in many cases, quite witty. So she left, well, we don't know how many letters she wrote, but 1,000 have been found and collected. So So, you know, those are the ones that people saved and, you know, could, you know, actually put together. Unfortunately, the other side of her correspondence, so all the letters she received from people, she instructed her sister to burn them after her death, which her sister did, which really hurts anyone who's interested in researching an author. But luckily, her sister did not burn the poem. So, you know, we can thank Lavinia Dickinson for that.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marta McDowell about her fascinating and beautiful book called Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, The Plants and Places That Inspired the Iconic Poet. Actually, before we get into anything else, I want to make sure that you explain one really interesting resource that apparently still exists, which is something called a herbarium that Emily Dickinson kept. This was actually a term I feel like I had maybe seen but never really properly understood before. Explain to our listeners what this herbarium is and what a valuable tool it is for us to understand better Emily Dickinson's relationship with flowers and other kinds of plants.
A herbarium, Greg, is a collection of pressed plants. And it's a term applied generically. In fact, the standard herbarium, you know, like any of the big universities or botanical gardens or arboretum would have this collection, and they're usually on individual big sheets of cardboard or paper. In Emily Dickinson's day, making a herbarium collection was also a very popular hobby, particularly among young girls and women. And Emily Dickinson actually writes when she's an adolescent to some of her friends, and she says, "Have you made a herbarium yet? You know, I hope you will. If you have not, it's, you know, it's so marvelous. And I'm sending you these little leaves and things that you can include in yours." So she would go out, she'd collect leaves or flowers, and she would press them. We think probably in books. She might have had a, you know, a purpose-built press, but we've never found one, and there's no mention of it. And then once they're dried, she would mount them in an album. Hers was actually bound, so it was like a photograph album. And there are 66 pages, you know, just kind of, I don't want to say crammed full, but arranged with these various specimens. So, you know, when you look through it, you can see the plants that she knew. Some of them are garden plants, and most of them are flowers. Many, many of them are wildflowers. And so you can see what grew in her area, because mostly she was doing this collecting by going out and walking around in the, you know, the woods and on the hills and fields and swamps and things that were around Amherst, Massachusetts.
That's such an amazing legacy to leave behind. And one of the things you tell us is that this is wonderful to look at, not just for the particular flowers, dried flowers and so on that are there, but also the artful way in which they are positioned on the various pages. I mean, it just speaks so much to her artistic sensibility on so many levels.
So it really is, it's a piece of, you know, sort of material culture. It's a piece of artwork in a very real sense. Some of them are clearly laid out as a design. Others are more scientific, where all of the, let's say, different violas, the violets and pansies, are arranged on a page together. So she would, it seems, experiment with things. And of course, we're just speculating because we don't have much in terms of her explanation for what she was doing, but at least the album itself was saved. It's now in the collection at Harvard, so it's very carefully preserved. But you can look at the pages. They've actually imaged them all, and they're available just to look at online, which is a great fun thing to do, too, if you're that kind of person.
Marvelous. In that same chapter, and actually, I should mention that one of the best choices I think you make in the way the book is constructed is that we proceed through various seasons beginning with early spring, running all the way through winter. I think it makes a whole lot of sense to do that. And I also appreciate the fact that that those turnings of the seasons not only reflect sort of the yearly life of a gardener, but also in a sense are a reflection in a sense of Emily Dickinson's own life as well.
Yes, that worked out well. You know, I wanted to talk about the seasons in her garden, but if we think of our own lives, right, we germinate, we're born, you know, we mature, we hopefully flower and set seed, and, you know, then we all die. And she does, you know, she writes a lot about gardening, and she does write a lot about life and death. So it seemed to make sense to match those two.
I like also in this chapter, one of the chapters devoted to springtime, some reference to Emily Dickinson's own education and the way in which through various excellent books she came to know a lot about the field of botany, even if she never, I think, formally studied it. And you quote one such textbook, Elmira Lincoln's textbook, Familiar Lectures on Botany, which says these words: "The study of botany seems peculiarly adapted to females. The objects of its investigation are beautiful and delicate. Its pursuit leading to exercise in the open air is conducive to health and cheerfulness." In other words, there were plenty of things in the mid-19th century that was not okay for women to do or okay for women to study. But botany was one field where it was perfectly fine. So in a sense, there's nothing all that exceptional about the fact that Emily Dickinson loved and was fascinated by plants, although maybe she took it to an entirely different level than maybe some others did.
Yeah, so she was lucky in that she was born into a family that believed that young girls should be educated, so that in addition to primary school, she was sent on to high school, and then she also attended Mount Holyoke, what's now Mount Holyoke College, for a year. And she studied botany in high school and college. She had that textbook, Mrs. Lincoln's Familiar Lectures on Botany. And in a funny way, that quote, which is, you know, we now would say, oh, well, you know, that's sexist, they're talking about women. But we're still talking about, you know, getting your children outdoors, nature deficit, you know. And so I think Mrs. Lincoln was sort of preaching the same thing, although, you know, clearly directed toward young girls because that's who she taught and wrote for.
I like another reference in this same chapter talking about how, while Emily Dickinson was studying at Amherst Academy, occasionally they were allowed to attend lectures at nearby Amherst College. And you quote Edward Hitchcock, the president of the college, saying, "We found that the admission of girls to such lectures, as they could understand, was a practice of some years' standing, and no evil had been found to result from it." So fortunate for Emily Dickinson that she lived in a place where the doors to rich educational opportunity were not at least entirely shut. She really had a deep and meaningful life there in Amherst.
Yes, and her family had always been connected with Amherst College. Her grandfather was one of the founders. Her father was the treasurer of Amherst College, and later on her brother became the treasurer of Amherst College. And so there were a lot of professors and college students. The Hitchcocks, you mentioned Edward Hitchcock, who was a noted scientist, and his wife is also one of the botanical artists who's represented in my book. They were friends of the family. So it was a very cultured life. She was in a fairly well-to-do family. So they had books, and she had opportunities to learn and really develop her skill, you know, her talent that she clearly had. Mm.
It sounds like one of the things that Emily Dickinson most loved to do was go on solitary wildflower walks, to the point where this was almost a source of concern, and maybe it is in some way a precursor of how she would live her life many, many years later when she began to withdraw. But tell us more about the ways in which her love of flowers was sort of lived out in her daily life.
Yes, so she did like to go on wildflower collecting walks, although I was really, you know, sort of amazed and pleased when I found out that in addition to going on her own, she also had a really big dog. You know, it was maybe a Newfoundland dog or a St. Bernard. It was a big black dog she called Carlo, and Carlo was his name. She called him my mute confederate, right? A very big, quiet dog. And so Carlo, you imagine her out walking, but then she would come home. She liked to plant things, so she would tend her flower garden. She had a lovely little conservatory that was attached to the house. And she worked with her sister as well. Her mother was also an avid gardener, so it's not like she was only out in the garden alone. And the Dickinsons had hired help as well, so I don't imagine that she did the heavy digging, but she certainly did a lot of different kinds of horticultural tasks.
At one point, you say that she was Catholic in her collecting. That is, I think, in her collecting of wildflowers. In what way did she have sort of a widespread interest?
Yeah, so in her collection of plants, she has, you know, some vegetables. You know, there are flowers from the tomato plant in there. There's a cucumber flower. She has a piece of seaweed. She has various things that are kind of funguses, like Indian pipes. There are many, many wildflowers, from terrestrial orchids to asters to daisies. There were native plants, not native plants, you know, things only from the flower garden, like Johnny Jump Up. So all sorts of things in there.
Explain this business of two different homes in which the Dickinsons lived. And if we go to Amherst, Massachusetts now, what can we see? What evidence is there of where Emily Dickinson actually grew up and exhibited this this love of all things green?
She was born in a house, a brick house on Main Street called the Homestead that her grandfather had built. And she lived there for the first 10 years of her life. It had fallen out of the family, so when she was born there, her father was actually renting part of the house. It had kind of been converted into a multifamily house. And then when he got enough money, he decided he was going to buy a house for the family. And they moved, oh, around a big block, so maybe a quarter mile away. And that's where she lived from age 10 to about age 25. So when she went to college, for example, that was the house that she left to go to South Hadley, to Mount Holyoke. In the North Pleasant Street house, she really wasn't writing much poetry, maybe, you know, 10 or 12 poems during that period. But her father buys the old family homestead back when it comes on the market. And he remodels it. He paints it this kind of light yellow color and puts a cupola on top. That's when the conservatory is added. So, you know, he kind of gussies it up. And it's in her 20s and 30s that Emily Dickinson is really prolific in terms of writing poetry. So there was something about the move back to that house or her level of maturity or something that really made her start to be very, very productive. And that's the house that's still there. And next door is the house that her father built for his son. So Emily Dickinson's brother and sister-in-law live next door. And so that's about the 3 acres of the original Dickinson property. It doesn't include the meadow that her father owned across the street. So there was a 10-acre meadow as well. So it was a very big piece of property.
Wow. And one just smiles thinking about the kind of joy that she experienced there and the way in it inspired so much of her writing. I want to be sure to ask you about something you say that's quite intriguing at one point. We not only learn about many of the specific flowers and plants and fruits that she loved and grew and tended and collected and so on, but there's a place in the book when you liken Emily Dickinson to one of the plants that she seems to have especially loved, something called Indian pipes. And you are basically saying that sort of the way Indian pipes function botanically is also, in a sense, a little bit the way Emily Dickinson interacted with the world. Explain to our listeners what you mean by this.
Yeah, so Indian pipes are this odd little, it's called a saprophyte. It doesn't actually photosynthesize on its own. It's completely white. And it does look like a little pipe. Maybe it's 3-4 inches tall, sort of bends over at the bottom. Some people call it a ghost plant. And it lives in a symbiotic way off of the roots of trees. So it has an exchange of nutrients with the tree roots. And Emily Dickinson, in her later life, in her, you know, especially into her 40s and 50s, she did gradually withdraw from society. And nobody really knows why. You know, was it medical? Was it something about her appearance? Was it psychological? Or was it her own choice, like, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe moving to the desert or something? So at any rate, she relied on her sister and the family staff. You know, her parents were gone by then, but, you know, she relied on them to do, transact her business for her, you know, do the errands, get the groceries. In a real sense, she relied on the postal service, you know, to take her messages, because she really was still very connected to people through the written word. She just didn't see as many of them face to face. There's one friend of mine who says that Dickinson would have been really great at texting all of her friends if she'd had that at the time.
Interesting, you know, to think about.
Yes, I mean, but, and one of the recent wonderful books about Dickinson is called The Networked Recluse. It's by a professor at Loyola, named Marta Werner, and she talks about Dickinson being very connected, even though she withdrew herself, you know, perhaps just to have the creative space that she needed.
In our last couple minutes, I want you to explain the beautiful final portion of the book, which is, I think, a part that, and actually the very final part of the book is what you call Emily Dickinson's plants, an annotated list. But you have a section before that called Planting a Poet's Garden. Explain to our listeners what they will see if they read these particular pages.
Well, I wanted to give people a way into having a little corner of their garden, you know, sort of reserved for Emily Dickinson. If you just wanted to have one plant that she grew, or if you wanted to recreate her garden, you know, here's a way that you could do it. It's always a lot of fun for me when I'm researching a book to put some plants into my garden that, you know, I've learned about from this particular writer. It's the reason my garden is really overcrowded, Greg. So at any rate, that certainly was the idea of it. Also, if any of your listeners want to come out from Wisconsin to Massachusetts, we always do one weekend in the summer when we have a big volunteer group at the Dickinson Museum where we all work on the garden to try to get it in shape.
Wonderful. Well, there is much more to explore in your lovely and intriguing and illuminating book, again titled Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, The Plants and Places That Inspired the Iconic Poet, published by Timber Press, the author Marta McDowell. Marta McDowell, thank you so much for taking the time, first of all, to create this lovely book, and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I've really enjoyed this. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. My pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is a special treat out of The Morning Show archives. Although I don't know.
I love long car rides, although I don't know why. I have restless leg syndrome and an annoyingly small bladder. I easily get highway hypnosis, and I almost always get lost. I like having our family together in one place, though, even if it takes door locks, seating restraints, and no safe exits to achieve it. We talk, we sing, and we argue. We've also listened to lots of great audiobooks over the years, and that's a wonderful way to take in literature. I've always loved reading aloud to my kids as well, but when I'm driving, I think an audiobook is safer.
And, of course, that unmistakable voice is that of Paula Poundstone. And it's someone many of you know, or you feel like you know, through her frequent appearances on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and on all of the other ways in which she brightens up our lives. And I'm really delighted to have Paula Poundstone on the phone with me to talk about her latest book, which is called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, in which Paula Poundstone explores with, in I think, just the right balance of hilarity and seriousness, what it means to be happy. And I'm really delighted to have this opportunity to speak with her about it. Paula Poundstone, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Hey, thanks so much.
Really glad to be talking with you. So tell us what the state of affairs was in your life about 7 years ago, which prompted you to start thinking about how you could be happier. I mean, how unhappy were you at that point in your life?
That it's that I was extraordinarily unhappy. I just was thinking that I wanted to find something that I could do that, you know, that that left me with like a residual feeling of happiness, you know? I mean, I do plenty of things that I enjoy, but what I wanted was something that buoyed me up during my regular day, you know, when I returned to it, when I returned to raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. So that was the point of the point of the experiments was twofold. The first point, I suppose, was to have the fun of writing. You know, I figured it was a great playground for writing funny stuff. And it was yet another memoir, which I get to keep writing because I'm not dead yet. So I would do the experiments, and as I was doing them, I would keep very careful and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written about what was happening, doing whatever the activity was, and then continuing to tell the story of returning to my regular life. And every chapter is written as a science experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the analysis is usually the part where I return to my regular life. And, it took place over the course of 7 years. Unexpectedly, I didn't. But, you know, some of the experiments were something I would do in a day. Like, for example, one day my kids and I, we had planned this for a long time. We were sure this was going to be the key to happiness. We were going to watch movies for the entire day. And by the way, it wasn't. My lower extremities ceased to function very early on from sitting in a chair for so long. It was good for having matted hair. If you wanted that, then it was just a thing to do.
You also mentioned that when you sent your kids off to the video store to rent what they wanted to see, that they, you said something about how they were inclined to choose their movies the way warriors choose weapons to inflict harm on each other.
You know, they normally when we would watch a movie, and my kids were raised, we didn't watch television when they were growing up. We only watched we watched a DVD or a video, but on a non-school night and only at night, never during the day. And so the idea of doing this was very exotic to us. And I have a huge collection of movies and old television shows on DVD and video. And so normally we choose from that, you know. But I foolishly, they hammered me into letting them go to the video store at the time to choose. And I swear my son went into the unwatchable section. He came up with some stuff that was so bad. And I didn't focus on that until we went to put them in. You know, we took turns, you know, whose movie we were going to watch. And, his stuff, he's my youngest and the only boy. And the tastes run afoul of good taste.
Of course, some of these experiments in the pursuit of happiness were much longer experiments, like the very first one you tell us about, which is all about getting fit. That was a bumpy road, wasn't it?
That took months. I took Taekwondo and self-defense, and they were grueling workouts. I was up to, by the time I stopped, I was up to doing 500 rope jumps, and that, by the way, is in a row. It was absolutely grueling. Although it was fun doing the workouts, And it did have a lasting effect. I wasn't particularly good at it. First of all, there's a lot of right and left in there's also do this with your right, do this with your left. I can't tell left from right. I don't know why. It must be some sort of a learning disability, but I cannot tell left from right. So, you know, the only way I could defend myself is if an attacker came at me from the right and gave me enough time to pretend to eat. To see which was my right hand, in which case, you know, we're totally protected. But otherwise, not so much. But they were. It did leave me with a lasting. I'd wake up in the morning when I was doing the Get Fit experiment, and there were times where I would wake up in the morning and really feel filled with possibility, which I have to say is not. That's not me on average. One day I was walking down the alley carrying trash bags full of cat waste and kitty litter, probably about a good solid 30 or 40 pounds, I'll bet you. And all of a sudden I realized, you know, I feel pretty good. And I thought, you know, it can't be the cat waste, because I've carried cat waste down the alley before, and I never felt that good about it.
Right.
So I do think it was the residual after effects of working out. Some of the things I tried because other people thought it would make me happy. Like, I did rent a Lamborghini for a day, and I have to say that there were times where it was kind of sort of fun, but not a lasting anything.
Right.
You know? Even when I was driving, you know, there were times, I'm driving the fastest car I'll ever drive in the city with the heaviest traffic. So there were times I got up to, you know, rip-roaring speeds of 20 miles per hour. but it just didn't, I don't know. You felt like a jerk driving it for the most part. It didn't fill you with happiness.
I remember at one point you said you would have enjoyed this so much more if you could have driven around in your Lamborghini in secret. I mean, without
right,
the rest of the world gawking.
Yeah, it's true. If it was just the act of driving the car, then it might possibly have been fun. It's just that it comes with too much baggage. Plus, you know, every time you hit the gas, you feel like, you know, it's like an oil embargo. You use so much. At that time, I drove a dented van with echoes of family arguments inside and Pop-Tart crumbs and, diet soda cans.
Not a Lamborghini.
Not a Lamborghini. In fact, one of the things I made note of with the Lamborghini right away, you know, I get in, I always carry a bag with me of, you know, sodas and water, and I turn to put my bag somewhere, and there is nowhere. Like, there's not a lot of space in a Lamborghini. And I thought, well, that's part of the reason people are happy driving it. You can't fit anybody else in.
Right. In the chapter called Get Wired, we have you describing yourself as this. I'm kind of Amish without the religious beliefs or the bonnet. You really began that chapter at a place where you were really very wary of the computer. It barely was touched. You didn't know how to use email or really anything that is so basic for most people. Tell our listeners a little bit about your effort to get wired.
I really was a blank slate when I came to it, which is sort of interesting. I mean, I didn't purposely, it wasn't intentional that it was that way, but it just was. It was one of the things that people kept telling me. You know, I had already written a couple of books, and people kept saying, "Oh, you'd love using computer. You know, it would make it so much easier. It makes life so much easier. It's so great to be online and connected," they would say. Now, we had a big computer in our house that my assistant used and my kids could use, but I didn't even know how to turn the thing on. So I went out and I bought a laptop, because a laptop you can bring door to door and beg for help, whereas the big kind you have to lure somebody into your house to help, which, let's face it, Jeffrey Dahmer ruined for everyone. So I went out and bought a laptop. One of the things that's interesting about the chapter is, because I was a blank slate, one really does see my sort of slide into the compulsions of checking things on social network or checking email once I learned how to do it. To the degree of losing sleep and losing focus on other things that are important, you really do see it as the giant time suck that it becomes for everyone who uses it, the difference being that most people had already been using it for quite a while at that point. And the other thing that's sort of interesting, and again, this was not by design, it just was what was happening in our lives. I foolishly put my son in front of a computer when he was 3 years old because I didn't know any better, and I believed I was giving him some sort of a leg up. And the girls were young too, but they weren't as young as he was. He ended up saddled with an electronics addiction and it is a real thing. And it just caused him, you know, an early lifetime of problems, and was, you know, really, really difficult for the whole family. But that ends up being chronicled throughout the book, mostly comedically, but it was a real thing.
Right. Okay. And I want to say I really appreciated how serious this book gets at certain points, especially as you're wrestling with certain real life issues. For instance, your beautiful daughter Tosha happens to be contending with cerebral palsy, and one of the really interesting threads in the book is your frustration with the low expectations that a lot of people would have for her, especially, for instance, her teachers. Yeah. And man, you had to really fight ferociously to get them to set the bar where it belonged for Tosha, in terms of where she...
And by the way, in a lot of ways, I was never able to get them to do all that they should have done. And we all, when you deal with somebody with a disability, I certainly have been guilty of shouting at blind people before. How you think, well, if they can't see, maybe they can't hear. So you just talk louder. And we all, no one wants to be the person to have asked more of someone with a disability than they could deliver. And so you immediately, and by the way, it comes from a kind place, not from a mean place, not from a rude place, but one has a tendency to lower expectations right away. Sometimes until you find, you know, your solid footing, until you gather, okay, now I know, oh my God, okay, she can't see, but she can hear, great, I don't have to shout, fine. right? It takes a little bit. In the case of my daughter, Tosha, she had a tendency to play people. So it was very hard for anybody to figure out what her, you know, what her threshold, what her ceiling was. And honestly, I'm not sure. I still know for sure. she's a piece of work. One of the things I tell the story of is her at camp going on a ropes course.
All right.
And it was one of the greatest athletic feats I have ever seen in my entire life. And it came as a total surprise to me, and certainly a total surprise to the people who ran the camp. She's affected mostly in her legs, in her balance, and she has huge upper body strength and no fear. That was the thing. You know, when she did the ropes course, she just had no trepidation. It looked like someone stepping on an elevator and stepping off again. It was an amazing thing to see. Right. And one of the chapters in the book is she and I go backpacking together. At the time, I didn't say in the book, I don't think, but at the time, I had a bad back. And she, of course, has cerebral palsy, and it was quite a trip.
Right.
At one point, I can't swear to this because I never saw it with my eyes, but I'm fairly certain that a bear came.
Well, you certainly saw a sign saying you are in bear country, which was actually not exactly what you were hoping to see. So
it was not. You know, I decided that we weren't in bear country anymore. I don't know why I decided that. But when I didn't see a flyer at this particular campsite saying so, and yet there were all these little squirrels around, and I didn't want them eating my Pop-Tarts, and so I committed a cardinal sin of backpacking, which is I brought the backpack with the food into our tent for the night. And somewhere in the middle of the night, some of the loudest snuffling I've ever heard in my life. And Tosha and I clinging to each other. It scared the hell out of us. We were clinging to each other like Laverne and Shirley. And we had headlamps on. So every time we looked at one another, we blinded each other for a few seconds. We eventually, and I'm fairly certain it was a bear, but we eventually drove it away by... We sang songs from The Harder They Come. And it's a little-known fact of nature, which is bears do not like songs of social struggle.
Well, we're glad you survived, because otherwise you wouldn't have lived to create this wonderful book, which, by the way, I've enjoyed in the audio version. So something like 6 hours worth of Paula Poundstone filling my house as I... cleaned my office. It gave me great pleasure. The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Paula Poundstone, thank you so much and best wishes. We wish you great happiness in the years ahead.
Thank you so much. It was nice talking with you.
Because of the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday, we will not be broadcasting the morning show over the next couple of days, but that doesn't mean you still can't enjoy the morning show. You just need to do so via the morning show podcast. Tomorrow on the morning show for Thanksgiving Day, I'm rebroadcasting my conversation with the co-authors of a lovely book called The 7 Laws of Enough, which explores the ways in which we can live lives of what the authors like to call sustainable abundance. On Friday, I'll rebroadcast my interview with John Eisenberg, talking about his wonderful book, The Streak. This book examines one of the most long-lasting and impressive records in Major League Baseball history, most consecutive games played, a record held for many, many years by the legendary Lou Gehrig, before it was finally broken by the great Cal Ripken. John Eisenberg examines the attention which that streak engendered at the time, other ball players after Lou Gehrig who attempted to break it, and how Cal Ripken finally managed to do so. On Saturday, I'll be rebroadcasting my conversation with Rick Ritté, author of a book called Don't Make Me Pull Over, which is a long and thorough and entertaining examination of the history of the automobile vacation, and it looks at things like what were the first hotel chains seen across the country? What were the early roads like? When were the first road maps developed, and so on? A really, really fun book. And the author, by the way, hails from Wisconsin. So you can subscribe to the Morning Show podcast by going to Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or Spotify. Make sure that you search for The Morning Show.